How long does a coronavirus last on surfaces?
The benefits of Alcoholics Anonymous.
How to treat persistent sciatica.
And a way to manage familial hypercholesterolemia. That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, of course, we're going to turn to top of mind for everyone, our selection for this week relative to COVID-19. That's in the New England Journal of Medicine.
This study focused on the stability of the virus. This is a novel study. It took the virus, now called SARS-CoV-2, for severe acute respiratory syndrome coronavirus 2, and they compared it to the original SARS virus, looking to see how long it persisted, if it was aerosolized, also if it was deposited on several different surfaces. So the way they did that was they took the two viruses, that is the SARS-CoV-2 and the SARS-CoV-1, and they submitted them to five different environmental conditions. They aerosolized both viruses. They looked at whether they would survive on plastic, stainless steel, copper, and cardboard, and then compared the stability of the two viruses. When they aerosolized either of these viruses, they could detect them for 3 hours. When they were put on plastic or stainless steel, they could detect virus up to 72 hours, and on cardboard, less than 24 hours. In the aerosolized form, the half-life was a little over an hour. On the surfaces in which they stayed the longest, that is on plastic and a stainless steel, the half-life was approximately 6 to 7 hours. We know that it's spread from individual to individual via droplets, cough and sneezing. Can it also be spread by someone touching surfaces, what's called fomite spread? And that's the way, by the way, SARS-CoV-1 was spread. This suggests that SARS-CoV-2 could be spread similarly.
Of course, there's lots and lots of emerging information relative to effective ways to actually disinfect surfaces, as well as all of the public health messaging regarding your hands and not touching nose, mouth, and eyes. I'm glad to see that this study was done. It's disconcerting that the virus can persist for so long on these inanimate objects.
In fairness, this is an experimental study, so it doesn't mimic true life. For example, these weren't exposed to UV light or outside light. We know that degrades viruses. They weren't subjected to heat at all. We know that degrades viruses as well, and obviously no disinfectants. So it was a very controlled experiment, but it does suggest that the virus can persist on surfaces for a prolonged period of time.
Good information for all the public health people out there and for disinfection people in hospitals and actually everywhere so that they can ramp up all of their procedures.
Right. And again, it's important to hand wash and disinfect surfaces, especially if you're sitting somewhere that you're not familiar with.
Also your cell phone. Let's turn from here to a Cochrane review. This is a look at something that also has a lot of impact on people, and that's alcoholism. This is a review that took a look at the ability of Alcoholics Anonymous and other 12-step programs for alcohol use disorder. Abstinence, reduced drinking intensity, reduced alcohol-related consequences, alcohol addiction severity, and healthcare costs. They included randomized controlled trials, some that were quasi-randomized controlled trials, and some other ones that compared these interventions, Alcoholics Anonymous or 12-step programs, with others, such as motivational enhancement therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, other types of interventions, and the healthcare costs. They ended up with 27 studies containing just under 11,000 participants, including only one purely economic study. They concluded that there's high quality evidence that what is called a manualized Alcoholics Anonymous or 12-step intervention is more effective than other established treatments. That means, is there a manual that people can follow that actually helps them to implement such a program? And that's in comparison to cognitive behavioral therapy for increasing abstinence. This is really good news, of course, because Alcoholics Anonymous is free, it's available widely, and people can participate in it without too many barriers to do that. So I was actually very uplifted by the results of this study.
Elizabeth, and I was too. As you mentioned, alcohol use disorders are a significant problem worldwide and the leading cause of death and disability among 15 to 59-year-olds worldwide. Alcohol Anonymous consists of several million members in 181 different countries, and it's a volunteer peer-to-peer organization. It is effective, and more effective than cognitive behavioral therapy or motivational therapy as well. Also, it bent the health curve cost. It was cheaper than the other therapies as well, so more effective and less costly. So, very good news.
Yep, we need to promulgate that. Let's turn to your next one, and that is back to the New England Journal of Medicine. When somebody has sciatica, that awful shooting pain that goes down people's legs often, what's the best treatment?
That's typically due to a herniated lumbar disc. Now, with conservative therapy, and someone has acute sciatica, about 90% of the patients improve within the next 4 months. In fact, there have been studies with acute sciatica that compared conservative therapy to surgical therapy and show that although surgical therapy in the short term relieves pain faster, over the longer term, 6 to 12 months, pain relief was the same for both. But that's with acute sciatica. So what about people that have persistent sciatica, people that have had symptoms for 4 to 12 months? Do those people do better with disc surgery or do they do better with conservative therapy? And that's what these investigators attempted to look at. So they had 128 patients enrolled, 64 in the group that were referred for microdiscectomy and 64 that were referred for standard therapy. And the outcome was pain relief at the end of 6 months and at the end of 12 months. Although patients started with a similar amount of pain on a scale of 0 to 10, with 10 being the worst, it was an average of about 7 to 8 in both groups. After 6 months of either standard therapy or surgery, those that had the discectomy had a much better pain improvement. So they rated it in those that had surgery at about a 3, and for those that had conservative therapy, about 5. A third of those that had conservative therapy ended up moving over to surgery because at the end of 11 months, they didn't receive any pain relief. Are there some downsides? There are. 9 of the patients that had surgery had some sort of a complication, either a dural tear, persistent pain, repeat herniated disc, or had an infection at the site of the surgery. So it does come at some risk, but it's clearly better at relieving pain than standard therapy.
Let's talk a little bit more about discectomy because it's undergone really significant modification in the time that we've been recording podcasts, for sure. It's way less invasive than it used to be.
Right, and I should better have termed this microdiscectomy, and obviously performed by surgeons that are familiar with the technique. These patients oftentimes go home on the same day.
So what would you say the take-home is? As you know, since I'm famously averse to those sorts of interventions, I might be more conservative than you.
Well, Elizabeth, again, it can be very severe and very debilitating pain. I think armed with this information, the individual can make a decision. If it really is severe and debilitating, knowing that they can get pain relief more effectively with microdiscectomy is helpful.
I guess the study I'd like to see as a follow-up would be how often, if a discectomy is performed at, let's say, L2, does a subsequent one develop at L3?
Well, it's funny you should mention that. Because of the 64 patients who were referred for surgery, one of them ended up with pain in the adjacent disc area. There were 2 patients that had recurrent herniation, and one of those underwent repeat surgery. So a relatively small number.
Long-term data needed. Let's turn to our final one for this week, also in the New England Journal of Medicine. Good news for the 1 in 250 people, and I had no idea that there were that many people who had familial hypercholesterolemia. This is a heterozygous condition, and I have been educated here in now recognizing that there are a number of genes that can be involved with this in this familial pattern of inheritance. Familial hypercholesterolemia, putting people at increased risk for cardiovascular disease and really dire cardiovascular outcomes. Previously, we've had antibodies against PCSK9. This is a drug that also works in the same place. It's called inclisiran. Inclisiran is a small interfering RNA. We've predicted in the past that we're going to be hearing a lot more about this particular class of interventions, and here's one of them. This was a phase 3 trial. They took a look at 482 adults randomized to either the inclisiran or placebo. They injected this drug on days 1, 90, 270, and 450. The good news is way less injection frequency compared to other previous therapies utilizing this pathway. As an outcome, they looked at the percentage change in the cholesterol, the LDL cholesterol, at day 510. What they saw was that there was approximately a 40% reduction in LDL cholesterol in those who were taking inclisiran versus 8% of those who were on the placebo. Really good news. What this small interfering RNA does is it inhibits liver synthesis of this component of the cholesterol. The only negative side effect that occurred in many of the people was injection site reaction. So this looks pretty good in the phase 3 trial.
The more LDL receptors you have, the more LDL cholesterol you can get rid of. PCSK9 breaks down LDL receptors. If we can minimize PCSK9, we can have more receptors. And that's how we're doing this, by either using antibodies, as in previous studies, or here using RNA to prevent PCSK9 production. The antibodies have to be injected every 2 to 4 weeks. The advantage of this particular agent is it was injected at baseline and it can be taken much less frequently, which would increase adherence. And as you alluded to, no serious side effects. A terrific study showing that by inhibiting PCSK9 by a different mechanism, that we can significantly lower LDL cholesterol.
And of course, confirming that is one of the mechanisms by which this aberrant atherosclerosis can take place. One question I have is, I'm wondering about this pathway in people who do not have familial hypercholesterolemia.
These agents have been shown to decrease, these agents, particularly antibodies to PCSK9, have been shown to decrease cholesterol in individuals in whom statins have not been effective in lowering it. That's regardless, by the way, of whether they have this particular variant.
And we'll see how all this transitions going forward. On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.